welcome to the Human Being Human. This is the Human Being Human.
This is the Human Being Human.
This is the Human Being Human.
Pod to the Human Being Human podcast.
This is the Human Being Human podcast.
Welcome to the Human Being Human podcast. I'm your host and creator, Carrington Cooper. Thanks for joining me for the next installment of the podcast series. In this season, we're going to switch up formats and change pace, although my home state of Nebraska will still remain the central focus point. After taking a deep dive into the history of the Cornhusker State last season, we're now going to listen in on some conversations and discussions I've had with my fellow human beings and fellow Nebraskans. Thanks again for lending us your ears for this podcast series. It's always greatly appreciated. In today's episode, I sat down and chatted with one of my good friends, Alexander James McAlpine. We met Alex's brother last week in our conversation with Cameron McAlpine. During my senior year of high school, I was a student aide to Alexander's sixth grade class, the same year I was a student aide to Brant Bechtold's fifth grade class, as we learned in the opening episode of this series. Alexander James McAlpine is an award-winning actor, a musician, as well as a filmmaker. During this episode, we talk about all sorts of topics near and dear to the two of us. Growing up and making movies about small-town Nebraska, creating music and playing shows together, as well as some out-there discussions, ranging from Friedrich Nietzsche to Bigfoot and beyond. I hope listeners at home enjoy our conversation, because I know we had a great time recording it. Without further delay, part two of my conversation with a fellow human being, Alexander McAlpine. We were in bands for a few years there. Do you remember what gigs stick out to you? And we've been talking about playing together. Do you have any, if I say, what's a memorable gig that you remember doing? Does anything immediately come to mind, or is it all too far and too abstract?
I can remember almost like every gig. I mean, we did like the Blank Slate. We did James. We did Y'all Come Back. We did like Happy Jack Tavern. We were at the River. We were at the Gravel Pit. We were at the Urban Theater. Like I can remember almost every location. That being said, I don't remember every gig. I remember a fun one being at the Blank Slate. Well, the Golden Husk now, but the Blank Slate in Ord, Nebraska, where we played as three different bands throughout the course of one night. To me, that was fun. I think we started as Bandana Brothers, and then we went and changed and came back on as Bigfoot and the Freedom Express. And then we went and changed, and then we came back out as Evergreen. And every time we came on stage, we would, you know, say big round of applause to the previous band. Those guys are great and all that shit. You know, like, to me, that was just a fun concept. And we kind of ruled the night and were able to sort of create that experience for everybody. That one sticks out. What about you? Do you have memorable gigs? Is there one that pops into your mind?
The reason that Blank Slate gig was memorable, because it was kind of the culmination of
all living together in Lincoln, me and Matt and Cameron, and we had made a lot of friends with all the foreign exchange students at Wesleyan that year, and they all came to that gig. It reminded me of, you know, the Beatles playing in Hamburg, Germany, like a bunch of teens going nuts for some rock music is kind of the sense I had. And they hadn't, that was obviously these folks' first experience with American rock music or whatever. And they seemed very, very into it. And it just seemed very, that was a unique audience compared to, you know, our bar gigs that we usually do. And so, you know me, I'm an archivist, so I can tell you specifically about all 56 gigs that we played or whatever the final number is. What made some unique compared to some others, sometimes it was just you, me, and your brother that played. We were just the Bandana Brothers. And then other gigs, we had collaborations where we had our musician friends come, and those were always memorable because they were usually off the cuff. So for me, one of the more memorable ones, and because I have recordings of it, it sounds great too, is when we played at Legends in North Loop, and Trissa played with us, and Brant played with us, and James Weber played with us.
Yeah, Jimmy played with us. That's right. Was that the New Year's gig? I think, did we play there twice or just once?
Yeah, we played there on New Year's with Clover.
Clover.
And then we played there in February with Trissa and the rest of the crew. That was one of those gigs where the room sounded really good, or it sounded unique. I think what's interesting is where you're playing kind of dictates how you play. And that's the kind of the nature nurture feedback loop. And that was a really loud room. It was like concrete floors, and it had a different energy compared to when we played at Jane's Tavern inside on July 4th or around the holidays that one time. It was just you, me, and Cameron in a pretty small space. And that it sounds great, but you can tell that we're playing differently because the room dictates how you play pretty much. And so compared, and then there's gigs where you play outdoors and you can play as loud as you want, and you don't have to worry about that. And so it's just interesting to me how the different playing environments influence how you play. When you get to the stadium level, if you're Tool or Foo Fighters, is that even a factor at that point? Does it matter if you're playing at Pepsi Center in Denver or Pinnacle Bank Arena in Lincoln? Does it become all the same at that point? That's what I'd like to know. You know, obviously I'd like to be a stadium touring band, but I wonder at what point, if you're just doing all stadiums, is one stadium just like every other stadium? Or I'd love to know how that works.
I would imagine, if I could venture a guess, I would imagine that for the most part, it's the same. But the things that they notice, I would imagine that out of a tour of 100 gigs, there are probably 15 gigs that they go, that place, for whatever reason, was something, you know? But I would also imagine that they have such a, just all the technical stuff down, that they're able to just deliver that product, whatever it is. They're not like having they're not having unknown factors sweeping into the stadium.
Did you know that Pearl Jam, Eddie Vedder comes up with a new set list every gig, that he writes it out, and his band members are expected to know every Pearl Jam song in their catalog. Pearl Jam's drummer used to be Soundgarden's drummer, and they hired him, and he was saying he had to learn 250 songs in 3 weeks before they went on tour, or a ridiculous amount, because Eddie Vedder will just come up with a set list literally right before the show, from what I understand, so it's not standard in that way, which I find pretty incredible. I got to see them in Lincoln at Pinnacle Bank, and it was a very good blend of that garage band, off the cuff kind of rock, and then that professionalism you have to have if you're playing a stadium gig. There still has to be, you can't break down and just say, oop, next song. And so I find that pretty incredible.
I do too, especially from a technical standpoint. I mean, I think the reason a lot of bands aren't able to do that is because, effects wise and all this stuff, I mean, they got people hitting buttons for them in the back of the stadium, And so to throw a wrench into that every single night, I mean, God, that'd be hard, but that's a perfect way to keep it fresh. It's just a matter, every gig is different at that point, and I would imagine that's got to be super fun.
I guess that's kind of a throwback to the Grateful Dead days, where you kind of just did whatever, and people just soaked it up, and it didn't matter. I wanted to switch gears and throw out a question that I don't know if you're prepared for or not. Both of us were raised in the land of Jim McAlpine and Nietzsche. I don't know if you have any formal education with Nietzsche or Nietzsche, as your dad would say. What does Friedrich Nietzsche mean to you as someone who only knows your dad?
Oh, God. Oh, God. I think the only Nietzsche work that I've read, I believe, translates to how to do philosophy with a hammer, I think, was one of his things that I read in actually philosophy class. It's so hard to say because of so much subjective experience, you know? I mean, my father almost deifies Nietzsche, you know? Nietzsche says. And in that, it kind of becomes, you know, I think you lose the meaning behind things when they become a mantra, you know? And so I've gotten to the point where I don't even really think about it anymore with him. I do think that, you know, I mean, there's so many innate concepts, like, you know, the way I understand the will to power based on how my father speaks about it, I think is such an apt way of describing the state of existence, you know, probably more apt than I think any religion, you know, but also I don't think it's something to be dogmatic about. I just think it's an interesting way to look at how everything works, you know.
It's descriptive more than prescriptive. Or if you look at it that way, then you can get rid of the dogmatic nature of it, that it's just a lens by which we might view reality. And who knows, but intuitively, it definitely hits some compatibilities for sure. That it seems right, I guess. And maybe that's living in the land of Nietzsche growing up, but that's how I feel at this point.
Yeah, I would agree with that pretty strongly. I've sort of veered away in the last few years from philosophy, where I used to be pretty enthralled by it. And I do still have a philosophical bent, you know, I'm definitely geared that way. But I guess I've kind of grown a little bit tired of trying to describe what's going on or understand what's going on and just let it go on, which is definitely more of like a Taoist, like Eastern concept, you know. I've definitely focused in on a lot of dualities recently, which I think are kind of at the root of you know, everything, you know, the balance between left and right, hot and cold, nothing, everything. I find that to be so pertinent and so relevant. And I guess I've just kind of grown away from trying to describe the state of being alive. And just try and be alive. And so in that, I've sort of lost some of my infatuation with philosophical concepts, especially Western philosophy, things like Nietzsche or, you know, Schopenhauer, Descartes, things like that.
A little pie in the sky at this point, that it needs a little more everyday practical use if I'm going to think about it too much.
Exactly. So I guess that's where I've grown to with that, what I would call an oversaturation of some of those philosophical ideas. I think I've grown from that oversaturation. I've kind of grown away from those things a little bit in the recent years.
Just the fact that people can function as individuals is a very new thing. You know, for most of our history, we were living in a tribal culture where you were absolutely tied to the people around you and you couldn't grow food or acquire anything without the need and necessity of others. And now in modern day living, even in the 1800s when Nietzsche was writing, you could leave. I mean, he lived a solitary existence, and that would have not been possible for most of human history. You couldn't just be in your bedroom and write a book, and that was just it. You know, I think that's interesting. That I think that will to power that he talks about applies to human groups as much as individuals. Human beings didn't evolve as individuals. We evolved as collective groups of people. And so you can't apply the will to power to a blood cell, individual blood cell, more than you can apply it to, you know, that we are human beings collectively, not individually. And so your individual blood cell is not going about doing its thing. It's going about doing its thing with every other cell in your body. And your blood cells aren't competing with your brain cells. They're working in tandem.
I think that's so true. And I think it's at the root of why there are such high rates of mental illness, especially depression and suicide rates all across the world in this increasingly abstract and overpopulated world that we live in. To me, it's so focused on individuality that I think there's a void there. And that leads to so many of these things that we see. And I mean, I think you can trace it back exactly to what you said, that for most of human history, we have not evolved to be individualists. You know, we've evolved in the presence of groups, and we're still made that way, but we've been taken from those groups. And I think there's a huge void left at that, which leads to things like, you know, like depression, like suicide, and all that different stuff.
What do you think about Bigfoot?
Oh, Bigfoot. God dang. I'm so conflicted.
What's the craziest thing you believe in? You feel a little personal investment in it.
Ah, that's such a good question. Craziest thing I believe in.
I shouldn't say believe in, but that you'd be willing to put money down, or that you're, you know, agnostic about. They say, yeah, you know, I think we probably both agree that maybe fairies don't exist or that sort of stuff. But there's some things that are clearly, you know, Loch Ness Monster, I'm pretty not into, but there's some things out there where I'm thinking there might be more to this story.
Where my mind kind of goes a little nuts is the concept of like relativity of time, and especially deep time, and basically the universe, you know? I mean, everybody gets pretty confounded there, but I'm just like, you know, like, where does it end? Like, what does it exist within? It must exist within something. And then I'm like, well, like I think of this example where there's a spider. One time I stepped on a spider when I was rock climbing, and I was like, that was probably that spider's first contact with a human being, and it killed it. You know, like that spider's whole life. And I'm like, what are we, like, if we're the spider, what's the human being that one day in the fraction of a second will wipe us out? You know, like, what do we exist within? Because if everything is comprised of microcosms, which I think it is, we're the microcosm of something so much bigger, you know? And to me, I'm like, it's that classic kind of cliche question, like, are we a speck of dust in somebody's coffee?
Right. And that's like a Men in Black movie where the galaxy is just on the little cat's necklace.
Exactly. To me, that's the stuff I think of. And it's not, you know, it's not crazy, but it's there's just no way to prove that sort of stuff right now.
The reason I'm kind of into the Bigfoot phenomenon, and I listen to a Bigfoot podcast pretty much every night. It sounds kind of strange, but that it comforts me, because it's a whole world that you can hyper focus in on. And if Bigfoot or this or whatever worlds that we don't know about end up actually existing, that's you know, a launching point into a whole bigger world. You know, we're kind of in this fractal kind of system where you have your small town, then you have the bigger world, and eventually now we're getting to kind of the cosmic level at this point. And so to me, all those kind of unknown things, paranormal, whatever, whether they're true or not, they offer a preview of something bigger. And if Bigfoot does exist, or we find solid evidence of spirits or ghosts or whatever that people have evidence of, like, that's a whole new ball game. And I think that's I'm completely agnostic about it.
Oh, yeah. I love entertaining those possibilities.
What I find fascinating is how big our world has gotten and how we completely take it for granted how big it's gotten. You know, our grandparents were born before we knew other galaxies existed. You know, 1929 was the first time that we even knew that there was something. You know what year we discovered other planets outside of our solar system?
No, probably in the 50s or 40s or something like that. I don't know.
1992.
It's like, what the fuck?
I was born before we knew of planets outside of our solar system, and now every four-year-old can tell you that, or every four-year-old can tell you that an asteroid killed the dinosaurs. If you put that idea out there in 19 80, you would have been a crazy lunatic. Like, asteroid killed the dinosaurs, and now it's something that's just completely mainstream. And
yeah.
When I graduated high school in 2007, the first papers were being published about a possible comet or asteroid impact that smacked North America 12,000 years ago. And that might have put us on a path towards agriculture and settling down and all that sort of stuff. And so we know that we now have evidence of this giant event that has only been since I graduated high school that completely changes the way that we view history. And so what are my kids going to take completely for granted?
Yeah, it's nuts. It's really nuts. Yeah, and to me, that's so interesting. That's happening at such a monumental speed right now. The abstraction that comes with having a population of near 8 billion people is just incredible. It's just unfathomable. And it's going to happen more and more and more, and science is moving so quickly with that many minds working on problems now, you know, that these things are just becoming, you know, accepted, found, debated, and accepted so quickly, so much more quickly than they were in the past. Super. One idea I really appreciate from the episodes that I listen to is the idea that all accepted science was once fringe science. Now, I like how you clarify many times, not all fringe science becomes accepted science, but at one point, all accepted science was lunacy. And, you know, maybe not 100% of the time, not all accepted science, but I would probably venture a guess that a sweeping majority of the things that we accept as just a given truth today was at one point, as you put it in the podcast, lunacy.
We've talked about how human beings were evolved collectively, but also individually, as far as the scale that we're on, you know, that we evolved in groups of 50 to 150 people, where you could change the world because your world was just that group of people. And we still have this this mindset, and we tell our elementary children, like, you can change the world. And forgetting, like, if we got 8 billion people, you know, that it's not, we still have that instinct because, you know, for millions of years, changing your world was, you know, maybe you find a stream that your group can drink from, or you spot a group of raiders coming over the hill.
God, like, if you created a new tool, like, holy shit, you know, that was monumental back in the day. I like the way that you said it, you know, and I think that in the future, we should probably start referring to things this way, is you can change your world. You know, that's a feasible thing. And that's where that idea sort of sprouts from, is in groups of 50 to 100 people, like you just said, you can change your world. That is the whole world. I think that's where the focus should be placed, because changing the world right now is just so, I mean, if you think about it empirically, like, the chances of you or any one person doing anything that anybody remembers for more than 5 years or 10 years after you're gone is astronomical. I mean, like the chances of being a Jeff Bezos or an Elon Musk or a, you know, these people that are making huge industrial and technological advances is just so, so small. So small, you know? It's not that you can't, like, You can't tell kids, like, you can't tell them that they can be president, but you also can't tell them that they can't, you know, because they're like, they can, but it's also just not a, it's not a, something that people should really be setting there. I don't know. It's another thing that I get confused about. So I just choose to be agnostic about it. Like, it's too complicated and confusing that I just kind of choose to not look at it.
The rubber is hitting the road for me when it comes to that concept, because since I was 16 years old, I had rock and roll fantasies and my musical heroes changed the world. And I thought, the only way I maybe can change the world is getting a really good band and selling 20 million records or whatever, you know, the bar I set for myself. And And now that I'm relatively sure that's probably not going to happen, and that's not necessarily my goal anymore, what do you do with that? You know? And so just trying to find a real world application to still be productive and creative and influential without taking over the world. As a 32-year-old, that's what I'm trying to, that's my life right now, I guess.
You know, as a 26-year-old, I'm at, you know, finding myself at that point is the same point you just described. Is it's like, what's the best thing for me to do right now? You know, what's the best? What is of the highest, what choice can I make that is of the highest quality over any other choice? You know, is it world domination? Is it just living a happy life by myself? Is it making money? Is it creating art? You know, what is it?
That speaks to that paradox and duality that we talked about with our, you know, you live in New York, I live in Denver, but we're small town people still. I would be as comfortable as I could ever be living in small town, you know, even Cook City, Montana with 30 people. But I also enjoy being around a million people too. And how do you balance that? And that's a conundrum not many human beings have had to face.
Yeah, a relatively small amount of people throughout a very small portion of time have had to reckon with that possibility.
And I think, you know, we do have, if you want to use the terms liberal and conservative mindset we've had for millions of years. If conservative means untrusting of strangers and liberal means trusting of strangers, we've had that group dynamic for millions of years, because as a tribal cultures, you had to be untrusting of strangers because they could potentially be an enemy, but you also had to be welcoming of strangers because they might bring information or knowledge or just new genes to the group dynamic that can also mean the difference between life and death for your group as well. And so you have to have that balance. If your group is completely trusting of strangers, you're going to get overrun before sunset. But if you're completely untrusting of strangers, then it's inbreeding central pretty much. And so I think human beings have had to balance that, those dualities for, you know, since before human beings, you know, going back to, you know, our Homo erectus days, you know, when we really began living in these self-sufficient tribal cultures. And so that's what we're dealing with today. And so I think evolution has a very, you know, you give it an inch and it takes it a mile pretty much. And that's how we are to this point. It's very good at filling in niches. And so niches.
I just looked it out the other day, actually. Somebody said it was a niche, and niche and niche are both accepted pronunciations of that word. Yeah, you're right. There's just no escaping the, you know, where you come from, you know, the way that we're built from where we've been. There's just no way of escaping that, and it's present in every moment, whether you're in a city, Silvergate, doesn't matter, you know, it's there for sure. It's just such a present concept to me all over.
What I find that very interesting, and given what we know historically and genetically now, that trust and distrust of strangers extended even beyond our own species. You know, if you do your ancestry.com or 23andMe, you can see how much Neanderthal DNA is in you, how much Gnosian DNA is, or all these different kinds of proto-human beings that we were mixing with back in the day. You know, that's something now my kids, we're going to take for granted. We all have a little bit of Neanderthal DNA in us. And 50 years ago, that's just complete lunacy, like we've talked about. To backtrack further with the Bigfoot kind of story, you know, I think that that can all kind of fit in there. We know that all these other groups of human beings existed. Maybe they still are around in some weird way. And maybe they got some weird things going on, because the Bigfoot phenomenon now has extended to kind of this paranormal world too. You should listen to episode 500 of the Sasquatch Chronicles. They have Survivor Man, Les Shroud, on there. Some people think he's really legit. Some people think he's a complete BSer. My instinct says, like, if there's one guy that you can trust, it's a guy that survived 7 days by himself under the most extreme circumstances. But he talks about filming Finding Bigfoot, his show, and having a paranormal Bigfoot encounter where the whatever it is was speaking to him through his mind. You know, they call that mind speak. And gosh, if he's not lying about it or he's not crazy, you know, assuming that's real, what does that mean? And that's just, you know, that's a crazy thing to think about. And my instinct, just knowing him, says I don't think he's just straight up lying. Maybe he's just straight up crazy. But I mean, that's the only three options. He's lying, he's crazy, or it's true. And so that's just, like I said, that opens up a whole new can of worms that is on par with other galaxies, other planets, you know, all the other recent history that we take for granted now.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It kind of reminds me of, I saw maybe a year or so ago, I think there was this movie called Translation, maybe? It had Amy Adams in it.
For the audience members tuning in at home, the movie is called Arrival.
And it's basically this alien species comes to Earth, and they have a way of communicating that basically defies the concepts of space and time. They have this language that's not just like a verbal language like we think of it. Like it's like made up of memories and you know, seeing the future and the past and being able to communicate through the mediums of time.
Language can influence your reality. For example, in German, the word for bridge is masculine, but in Spanish, it's feminine. If you grow up thinking of bridges in a feminine way, that's going to paint your reality about what a bridge is, you know, or if you grew up with them in a masculine way, that's going to paint your reality. And so that movie takes that to the, you know, the sci-fi extreme.
And I think what I find particularly interesting about it too is the concept of malleability in an evolutionary sense. And I guess what I mean by that is that like there have been periods of history where people have taken chimps, you know, young chimps, and they live with them and literally almost turn them into like human beings. It's really, really crazy. I think there's a Radiolab episode about it. I think his chimp's name was Lucy or something like that. Literally like would make tea for the family, you know, and like read girly magazines and wear like dresses and stuff like that. Like, wow. Okay. So when you take a species like that, and then a species like us, the only reason that chimp is doing any of that stuff is because it's got a ontologically higher species showing it these things. And humans don't have that right now. We don't have anything that's pulling us out of ourselves into a new realm of potential. And to me, Translation touched on that, was that humans are probably capable of all of these things, of connecting to the worlds of space and time through thought and meditation and all this stuff. But we have just rare glimpses of it because we don't have a species that is pulling us outside of ourselves like humans are with chimps or things like that. So that concept of malleability, to me, I know there's so much potential in all these things we're talking about, like, you know, the paranormal, you know, universe, where it starts, where it ends, yeah, Bigfoot, all these things that we don't know about. They're potential things that, like you said, if these things turn out to be true or become accepted science, it opens up a brand new world that we're able to then inhabit it. You know, you can't inhabit it until you know about it.
I think about human adaptability and malleability, kind of this thought experiment I have, where if I could travel back in time, how much time would it take to explain retroactively how we got to here? You know, if I could travel back to 2010, I could sit someone down and talk them through it pretty quick. Go to 1990, it's going to take a little bit longer. You know, at what point is it ununderstandable? And you know, I think someone from 1940 could understand how we got here, you know, but and given enough time, you know, assuming that they wrap their head around the time travel thing, you know, if they just wanted to understand the future, at what point would it be ununderstandable?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, they're pre 1870s, you know, like that whole, I don't know if that was the first industrial boom or the second, you know, industrial boom, but like before the invention of oil, not the invention, but, you know, the discovery and incorporation of oil into our daily lives. That's such a huge concept for a lot of people pre that time that that you just have to explain some really, really fundamental things to them before you can get into the more abstract concepts of like the internet. It's like the internet exists because of oil, you know, like it's kind of weird.
Maybe a good real world example of that concept in action is when Captain James Cook landed in Australia in the 1790s. He discovered a culture that had been unbroken for 65,000 years. You know, that the first group of people that left Africa made their way to Australia and then pretty much got cut off. And they were able to catch themselves up. You know, a lot of Aborigines now are bush pilots. You know, they can understand flight and they can understand, you know, everything that the modern world needs them to understand. And that's a culture that, you know, obviously it's not literally traveling back in time, but you're finding a group of people that are living as if it's 65,000 years ago. And so, because you go back 75,000 or 90,000, you know, at what point is it, you know, and obviously we can't ever know, but that kind of thought experiment intrigues me. You know, that's what I stay up at night thinking about.
Yeah. To me, it touches on what we just talked about, where once you get back that many years, you know, over 10,000 years, even, yeah, I mean, maybe 10,000 years, you're almost dealing with a different species in a way. Very minutely, like we're obviously so similar, but in terms of like the ideas and the knowledge, you're almost dealing with a different species. And to me, it's almost like what we just touched on with Arrival and with this chimp living in, you know, a human world, is that we're almost a different species to them, and we're able to pretty easily bring them into our world. Like, it doesn't take long for people to understand those concepts, because the concepts are within us already, you know. And so, you know, the fact that these Aborigines are bush pilots and fully living within the modern world, to me, I guess is not terribly surprising.
Proof of concept, I guess you would say. You know, I think we agree that if you took a baby from 1870 and plucked them into the modern world, it'd be like any other baby. You know, and you know, how far can you go back? You know, evolutionary and, you know, all that sort of thing. Anthropologists now, to their best guess, believe that even though human beings have been around for about 300,000 years, modern anatomically similar human beings have been around about 75,000 years. That if you probably took someone from 250,000 years ago, there might be a gap there that might be too wide to traverse. Climatic change has guided evolution throughout our history, and something happened 75,000 years ago. And then we all left Africa, and, you know, fast forward, here we are. And so I think, you know, at what point do those gaps become unpassable?
One day we'll know, assuming we don't wipe ourselves off the face of the planet. I think one day we will be able to answer those questions. If we buy ourselves a new, we buy ourselves another half a millennium or something, you know, or a millennium. If we can buy ourselves some time here, I think we'll be able to figure those questions out, actually.
There's some folks that think we got, you know, if we can make it to 2049, we're going to run into the singularity, that computer power is going to, you know, completely change everything, and that these answers that maybe we think are a millennium off are maybe only 50 years off.
You know, at the current rate of abstraction and scientific discovery, would not be surprised. I think it's going to come down to, with the little amount I know, you know, this is my intuition talking, I guess, if we're able to find a way to sustainably live here for that amount of time, it could be that quick. It really could be. Who am I to say?
There you have it, folks. Part two of my conversation with my good friend, Alexander McAlpine. As always, thanks for listening to the Human Being Human podcast. I'm your host and creator, Carrington Cooper. Please join me for the next episode, and we'll see each other on the other side. You can follow this podcast on Facebook, Twitter, as well as Patreon. I'll be posting links to all the references mentioned throughout the series, as well as any stories, videos, articles, or other cool stuff that might be of interest. In today's episode, we heard Alexander and I's former band, Evergreen. In the intro, we heard the song Acapulco, recorded in 2013 at Studio PH in Lincoln, Nebraska. In the outro, we'll hear the song Sea Song, recorded live in 2013 from the Blank Slate Theater in my hometown of Ord, Nebraska. As always, I appreciate all of your ears and support, and we'll see you next time.